39. We'll read the entire psalm, 24 verses, very familiar psalm. O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my down-sitting, mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, Thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid Thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from Thy Spirit? Or whither shall I flee from Thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, Thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, Thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall Thy hand lead me, and Thy right hand shall uphold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from Thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to Thee. For Thou hast possessed my reins, Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Thy works, that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from Thee, when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being imperfect or unperfect. And in Thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. How precious also are Thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more than the sand. When I awake, I am still with Thee. Surely Thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men. For they speak against Thee wickedly, and Thine enemies take Thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate Thee? And am I not grieved with those that rise up against Thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. It's not our purpose tonight to go into great depth in this psalm. We just kind of want to skim this 139th psalm. It is a psalm of David, and it is one of the most notable of the psalms. In this psalm, we see David is personally speaking to the Lord. He is speaking to God. And it's a wonderful thing that we can speak with God. It is something that we ought to avail ourselves of, to speak with God. If I counted right, David makes 85 references to God and himself in this psalm. From that, we see that in David's mind, there is a connection. There is a relationship between who God is and David's life. And that's so very, very important. So again, we'll say approximately, because I may have missed some, but approximately 85 times, David mentions God, and he mentions himself in this psalm, which brings us to the thought of God and me. God and me. In this psalm, David, with great reverence, meditates and contemplates upon some truths about God. These truths, as all truths about God, show the awesomeness of God. And we see that it shows the marvel of God, the greatness of the Lord. And as David thinks upon these things, he's filled with awe. He's filled with wonder. He's filled with amazement. It's seen in those words, they occur four times. O Lord, O God. They occur there in verse 1, verse 4, verse 17, and verse 19. And they are words of awe. They are words of amazement. It's a word of exclamation. O Lord. Notice that he begins his conversation with God with a note of exclamation. O Lord. That's how he begins. And that's how we ought to begin when we talk with the Lord. It ought to be a point of exclamation. It ought to be a marvel. It ought to fill us with awe. And this is where he began, talking with the Lord. He's filled with awe. He's filled with wonder. He's filled, again, with amazement. It's also expressed there in verse 6. He says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too wonderful for me. And then he goes on and he says, it is high. I cannot attain unto it. He's in awe of God. And I'm glad that I have a God that awes me. I would not want to have a God that does not fill us with a sense of awe. And as David thinks upon the great truths of God, he recognizes that they're somewhat mysterious. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. There's a degree of mystery about God. He also goes on to say there in verse 6 that they are beyond full comprehension. Again, and I'm glad that I have a God that not only fills me with awe, but I am glad that I have a God that is beyond my full comprehension. You realize how small God would have to be if you and I could fully comprehend him? If we could fully understand God, it would be a small, small God. The truth is, he'd have to be smaller than ourselves because we don't fully comprehend ourselves. So I'm glad that I have a God that I cannot fully comprehend. Don't let that depress you. Don't let that discourage you that you cannot fully comprehend God. That ought to excite you. That we do not fully understand God. We can't explain God in entirety. We can't explain why God does some of the things he does. We can't explain that. But it ought to rejoice our hearts that we cannot fully comprehend the Lord. That shows his greatness. Now, the psalm is basically, we see it's got 24 verses. And it's basically divided into four stanzas of six verses each. And each stanza focuses upon a specific truth about the Lord. And each of these truths, as David is talking to God, each of these truths are very emphatically stated. That is, they're stated without any sense of doubt. They're stated without any sense of uncertainty whatsoever. And again, I'm glad that I have a God that though he is beyond full comprehension, I can have full assurance concerning him. That's the kind of God that we have. He is beyond our understanding. But yet at the same time, we don't have to fully understand him. We can still be assured and certain of who he is. And many times when you do not know why, it's because you don't need to know. But what you do need is an assurance of who he is. Assurance of who God is. Again, David views these truths concerning God as they personally relate to himself. He sees these truths concerning God as connected to David, as pertinent to his life. And again, I'm glad that I have a God that though he is beyond my full comprehension, he takes an interest in me. And in this, I can be certain. I can be sure. So as David thinks upon these truths, he's overwhelmed. And again, I'm glad that I have a God that overwhelms me. If your thoughts of God do not overwhelm you, you're way off in your thoughts. As he thinks upon these great truths, as you read through the psalm, you see that he is personally moved and affected. And again, I'm glad that I have a God whose greatness moves and affects me, moves upon us, affects our thinking, affects the way we feel. As David thinks upon these truths concerning God, he is also, as you read through the psalm, he's filled with desire. He's filled with a desire of heart toward God. This psalm reveals to us that these truths that David mentions and these truths that David is thinking upon were not merely points of theology. Again, I believe our theology ought to be as sound as it can possibly be. But if that's all you have is theology, you don't have much. Theology by itself will not bring you comfort. But what David is speaking of is more than theology. It was reality. It was real to his life. And I'm glad that we have a God that's more than theology. I'm glad that we have a God that goes beyond the abstract. He's real. So let's look at the truths that David states about God. And again, he speaks of each of these truths, he speaks emphatically. He speaks with absolute certainty. He begins by speaking of the infinite knowledge of God. In verse 1, he emphatically states a general fact about the intimate, perfect, flawless, complete, and absolute knowledge of God. He says emphatically and with much assurance, God knows me. That is, right now, at this very moment, God knows me flawlessly. You don't know yourself flawlessly. God knows me flawlessly. God knows me completely. We don't know ourselves completely. God knows us absolutely. Now notice the words that David uses to describe this knowledge of God in verse 1. Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou hast searched me. That is, investigate. Thou hast known me. That is, God has recognized fully, flawlessly. God has recognized us, and God has noted. God has noted in His mind everything that there is possibly to know about us. He is recognized and He is noted. Verses 2 and verse 4, He mentions 7 specifics used to describe this knowledge of God. And again, it's important that we recognize that everything He's saying here is in present tense. But notice 7 specifics that He mentions concerning God's knowledge of Himself. Thou knowest, that is, God recognizes, God takes note, my down sitting. God notices when we sit down. God knows why we sit down. And mine uprising. He knows when we sit down. He knows when we get up. Now notice, He uses the word thou knowest. But then when it comes to our thoughts, which is the third area of His knowledge of us, thou understandest my thought afar off. Why didn't He say, thou knowest my thought afar off? Certainly He does. Certainly that would be true. But He says here, thou understandest my thought. He not only knows, and He does so when our thoughts are far off. In other words, He knows what we're going to think before we think it. But not only that, He knows why we think what we think. You and I don't even know why we think what we think sometimes. But God knows why we think what we think. And He understands the reason. That doesn't mean, we're not using the word understand here like most people use it, that you're approving of something. Simply means that He knows everything there is to know about your thoughts. He knows why you think it. He knows the very nature that makes up those thoughts. So He knows our down-sitting. He knows our uprising. He knows our thoughts. So when you sit out and think, He knows all about it. When you stand up and think, He knows all about it. He knows why you sat down. He knows why you got up. And He knows why you thought what you thought. These are amazing things. Verse 4. Thou compassest my path. That's the fourth thing. He knows when we sit. He knows when we rise. He knows our thoughts. He knows our path. That is what we do during the day, where we walk, where we go. And my lying down. He knows when we lie down. And then He says, and thou art acquainted with all my ways, which would include everything that He said so far. It would include the down-sitting, the uprising, the thoughts, etc., and everything else. He knows all my ways. And then the seventh thing He mentions, for there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, Thou knowest it thoroughly, altogether. There is not a single word that He doesn't know. He knows every word that you would have spoke, but He restrains you from speaking it. He knows every thought that's gone through that mind that could have been a word. He knows it all. He knows exactly what you meant by every word you say. When we sing, He knows exactly what we mean, every word that we sing. And that's a scary thought. So He mentions seven things concerning God's knowledge. In other words, nothing about me, nothing about you is excluded from the knowledge of God. Whether it be public or whether it be secret. Whether it be sitting down in public or whether it be sitting down in secret. Whether it be getting up in public, doesn't matter. It covers the public, it covers the secret. He knows the motive behind everything we do. He knows our intent. He knows the motive and the intent of every single action. He knows. We need to keep those two words in our mind. He knows. He knows. He knows all things. He knows all things at all times. He knows all things at all times at the same time. But be sure of this. He knows. He knows. In verse 5, we see that every aspect of our life is surrounded by the knowledge of God. He says, "Thou hast beset me behind and before," in the context of His knowledge, "and laid thine hand upon me." That is, we're surrounded by His knowledge. There's no escaping the knowledge of God. It is an act of practical atheism. Again, Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God." It doesn't say the fool hath said there is no God. That's true, but it says the fool hath said in his heart. You and I commit that sin. It's called practical atheism. We say we believe God, but we live as if there were no God. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And to think that you and I can do anything in secret is an act of practical atheism. His knowledge surrounds us. It covers everything in our life. But I am glad that I have a God who knows me. And I'm glad that it is a knowledge that I cannot fully comprehend. That is a great source of comfort, that God knows me. That is a great source of confidence. He is not blind. He is not ignorant of my condition at any time. He is not blind and He is not ignorant of my circumstances. I am never out of the mind of God. Never. I was on His mind before I was even created. So we say we've never been off the mind of the Lord. Living in the awareness that He is aware will change the way we live. Living in the awareness that He is aware will make us careful. He knows. He knows. That thought ought to also fill us with great humility and gratefulness and praise. Because really what it does is it magnifies His love and blessings to us. If there was anybody in the world that knew every thought that went through your mind, you would not have a friend on this earth. Not one. Not one. You wouldn't even like your own children. And your children wouldn't like you if they knew every thought that goes through your mind. So it amazes me that God knows everything about us, and yet He loves us. That magnifies the love of the Lord. And that alone ought to fill us with humility. That alone ought to fill us with great thanksgiving for His love, for His blessings. How you and I can complain that we haven't been blessed like so-and-so it's a great manifestation of ignorance. God knows us. And it's amazing that He blessed us one time, let alone twice, and three, and four, and five, and on we go. Innumerable times. In verse 6, concerning this knowledge of God, David says, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. I cannot attain unto it." Again, I'm glad I have a God that overwhelms me. I'm glad that I have a God that I do not fully comprehend. Verses 7 through 12, he speaks emphatically about the presence of God. Some people are off in their theology. They believe, or at least they say it this way, that the reason God knows everything is because He's everywhere. That's not true. The reason God knows everything is because He's God. And the reason God is everywhere is because He's God. You see, God wouldn't have to be everywhere to know everything. But He's both. He's omniscient, that is, all-knowing, and He's omnipresent. The question of verse 7, "Whither shall I go from Thy Spirit, or whither shall I flee from Thy presence?" I don't believe that question is indicative of a desire to escape God's presence. But it is indicative of this fact: there is no place that I can go. There is no place where I can be that God is not. And that's something to rejoice in. No matter where I go, God is there. There is not a corner of the universe. There is nowhere you can go. God is not there. So, oh, how foolish to try and run from God. Where are you going to run to? He's everywhere. How foolish to try and hide from God. He's everywhere. Everywhere, and may I say, not only is He everywhere, but everywhere He is, He's God. That rejoices my heart to think everywhere He is, He's God. Notice in Jeremiah, keep a mark there in Jeremiah 23, verse 24. "Can any hide himself in secret places that I shall not see him?" The places are only secret in our minds, saith the Lord. "Do not I fill heaven and earth?" saith the Lord. It doesn't just say, "Am I not in heaven and earth?" It says, "Do not I fill heaven and earth?" And then back in our text in verse 8, he emphatically speaks of the vertical presence of God. "If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there." That's the vertical presence of God, up and down. No matter where you go up, no matter where you go down, notice two times he says, "Thou art there." What a blessing to know wherever I go, thou art there. The God who knows me, He's there. Cannot escape. Then he speaks of the horizontal presence of God. "If I take the wings of the morning," that is flying east to west, "and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea," referring to the Mediterranean Sea, "even there thou shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me." no matter where you go. Vertically, horizontally, God is everywhere. He is saying here, if I could go from the east across the sky to the west, and if I could go all to the furthest part of the Mediterranean Sea, thou art there. Thou art there. And then in verse 10, even there. He's awed. Even there. There's nowhere you can think of. Even there. God is there. Here, there, and everywhere. God. What a comfort. Here, there, and everywhere. It's not just that He's there, but He's God. Here, where, and everywhere, God. No place has any effect upon Him. Doesn't have any effect upon who He is. Doesn't change Him. Again, this is a source of confidence. This is a source of comfort. Verse 11 and 12, he goes on about God's presence as being inescapable. Not that he wants to escape God's presence, just stating a fact. He says, if I say, that is, if I think in my mind, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee. Notice that. The darkness hideth not from thee. Oh, it hides from you and me, but it doesn't hide from Him. But the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. There's no difference. This is convicting. This is humbling. Because what this means is that every sin we commit, whether it be an outward sin, whether it be an inward sin, every single sin we commit, every single act of rebellion, every step of waywardness is done right in His face. He's there. He's there. We need to always remember that. There are things that you would not do in the face of another human being, perhaps. But yet, every sin we commit, we do right in the face of God. But again, it's a part of that practical atheism. We somehow convince ourselves that God isn't present, that God isn't observing. But He always is. Then he speaks emphatically of the infinite power of God. This is seen in verses 13 through 18. And in these verses, he draws our attention to God as our Creator. God as our Creator speaks of His power. It speaks of His authority. It speaks of His ownership and His rights. You see, whether you are saved or lost, God is your Creator, and therefore God has authority over you, and God owns you, and God has rights over you. Again, we've said many times, I get so tired of hearing about people's rights. What about God's rights? God has all right. All right. He's Creator. You and I that are saved add to that, He's not only our Creator, He's our Redeemer. That makes us even more responsible. Notice verse 13. For thou hast possessed my reins, my inward parts. Thou hast covered, that is, woven me intricately in my mother's womb. Such a thought overwhelms him. In verse 14, he said, I will praise thee. For I am fearfully and wonderfully made. See, even a lost sinner is to praise God. because he's a creation of God. And just thinking about God's creation of us ought to be enough to evoke praise. You add to that fact redemption, and we ought to be out of our minds with praise. We ought to be completely overwhelmed with praise. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. He goes on, he says, my substance, that is my skeletal frame, was not hid from thee. These are fantastic verses for anyone who is ignorant enough to believe that one is not a human being in the womb. When I was made, that is formed and shaped in secret places or in secret, which would be the womb, and curiously wrought, embroidered, speaks of detail, it speaks of precision, speaks of exactness. He's talking about his creation. In the lowest parts of the earth, thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, that is, not fully formed. But God saw it all. God saw it all. You know, we read there concerning the Garden of Eden, and we are created in the image of God. That's true in a sense that most people never think of. That's true physically. Christ's body was not designed after ours. I'm talking about his human body. God had formed the human body of Christ in his mind before he created us, and we were created in the image of that physical body. That's another subject, but again, he's talking about the fact that we are handmade by a master craftsman. We are a created marvel of God. That fact alone makes us responsible to God. That ought to fill us with praise. David found these thoughts very comforting and encouraging. He said in verse 17, how precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God. What he's saying is, he's just finished talking about how God saw him before he was completely formed, and how God is thinking upon him. And he says, how precious also, in addition to what he said, are thy thoughts unto me, O God. As he spoke of the greatness of God, he found himself where he could not stop thinking about God. Isn't it amazing how quick we are to stop thinking about God and some of the stupidest stuff on planet Earth we can't stop thinking about? How great is the sum of them? If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I'm still with thee. Oh, how true. What have we to be sad about? When I wake up, there he is. He's there. So I'm glad that I have a creator God. I'm glad that I have a sustaining God. Verse 19, he begins another subject, and we'll hurry on. But he emphatically states the righteousness and holiness of God. He says in verse 19, surely, that means most certainly, without a doubt, thou wilt slay the wicked. May I say, to slay is an act of violence. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked. It doesn't just say that God will take away the breath of the wicked. It says much more than that. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men, speaking of the wicked. What this verse declares is that God hates sin. God hates sin. He hates every sin. You and I have a tendency, because we don't fully comprehend sin, and you cannot fully comprehend sin unless you fully comprehend the holiness of God. And we can do neither. So we have this tendency to put sin in different categories. God hates all sin. He hates it. And what this verse declares is that justice will be executed, and when it is, it will be right. I'm glad that I have a God who always does what's right. You and I may not understand it. You and I may not understand why much of a nation is wiped out by an earthquake or a tidal wave or whatever. And immediately people will say, why? And then you get these ignorant preachers on television to assure everybody that God didn't have anything to do with it. It's amazing. Well, if God didn't have anything to do with it, who in the world did? And what comfort do you get out of that? This is what they're saying is, this is out of the control of God. Oh, that's comforting. That'll make me sleep well tonight. But that's what they say. Again, anytime there's a so-called natural disaster, they get a preacher, and again, God didn't have, we just want, we don't understand why, but we know God didn't have anything to do with it. God had everything to do with it. He's in control. And we don't have to understand why. All we have to understand is God did it, God allowed it to happen, it's right. That's it. We don't have to explain it. I've had many times people say, you tell me why God allowed this to happen in my life. And I don't, sometimes I may think I have a guess, but I have no idea. I have no idea. But you need to trust Him. You need to trust Him. Then notice the practical effect of all this upon David. David has, with the utmost certainty and confidence and conviction, declared that God is all-knowing. He has declared that God is everywhere present. He has declared the absolute righteousness, holiness, and justice of God. He has declared the power of God in creating us. And if we were to ask everyone here tonight, do you believe that God knows everything about you? Everyone here would say, yes, I believe that. I don't have any problem believing that. There isn't anyone here, I'm sure, that has any problem believing that God knows everything about me. Do you believe that God is everywhere? Oh, yes, I believe that God is everywhere. Do you believe that God has created you? Everyone here would say, yes, we believe. There's no doubt in our minds that we are the creation of God. Do you believe that God is righteous and holy and just in all things? And everyone here would again answer in the affirmative, yes. We believe all of those things. These are things that we believe. But I suppose we need to examine, how do these things affect me? What effect do these truths have upon my heart? What impact do these truths have upon my life? The structure of the psalm reveals that there ought to be a connection between what we say we know and what we desire and what we do. We see that as just the basic structure of the psalm. Again, the psalm is filled with emphatic statements and declarations about the greatness of God, and that evoked a desire to praise Him. In verse 14, I will praise Thee. I will praise Thee. We need to think upon God. We've said this many, many, many times, and we'll say it many more. You need to meditate upon who God is. You need to think about that every day. You cannot not think about God and worship. And that's what people are trying to do today. Not think about God at all, but we'll worship Him. No, you won't. How can you worship Him if He's not even in your thoughts? And we're to worship Him every day. We're to take some time and we're to meditate upon who God is. And that fills us with praise. And once you start thinking about who God is, and you start meditating upon the greatness of His person, those thoughts aren't easy to turn off. And they have an impact upon your life. But notice, we see how David begins the psalm. And then we see in verse 23 and 24 how he ends it. He ends the psalm expressing a desire of his heart. In verse 23, now let's read verse 1 again. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. So he has already experienced the searching and the knowing of God. Now notice what he prays for in verse 23. Search me. In light of verse 1, does that not mean continue to search me? Because he's already experienced the searching. Search me, that is, God, probe me. Investigate me. Explore me. Search me. That ought to be our prayer every day. Not for God to have information. God doesn't need to search us to have information. We need God to search us so that we know. Search me. How many of us desire to feel the probing of God? You can always tell when someone begins to feel that God might be probing in an area in their life. They start to squirm. They start getting uncomfortable. They do a lot of things. But search me, probe me, and know. He said he'd already been known in verse 1. What he's desiring here is an intimacy with God. Know my heart. Know my heart. Not that, just not know what I do. Know my heart. Because again, that's where it all is. Try me. Test me. Put me to the test. God doesn't test His people for His information. He already knows. But He tests us for our information, that we might know where we are spiritually. God will put things in our lives that will prompt a reaction of some kind from you and I. That's a test. And it reveals where we are spiritually. We ought to desire those tests. Why? Because we ought to desire to know where we are spiritually. and know my thoughts. You ever think about your thoughts? You ever really go deep into your thoughts? Why do I think that? Why did that thought just cross my mind? We ought to be willing for God to investigate our thoughts for our sake. Then he says, and see. What that means is communicate with me if there be any wicked, offensive way in me, which refers back to my heart. Verse 23. Communicate with me if there be anything offensive in my life. Now, a lot of times, I didn't say all the time, I said a lot of times, when someone says, tell me the truth, don't be foolish, you better realize who you're talking to, because the truth may not be what they want. Their idea of the truth and your idea of the truth can be two completely different things. But God's all-knowing, and it ought to be our desire, Lord, you tell me in every way that my life is offensive to you. He goes on, he says, and lead me. That is, again, this shows our depravity. Even if God comes to us and says, Brother Dan, this, 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 and just gives me a list. These are all the things in your life that offend me. What would I do with it? Nothing. Unless he causes me, he leads me, he induces me and moves me in his way. That's how depraved we are. We say, oh, if God would just tell me. Well, that's not enough. We desire for God to tell us, but if he just leaves it there, we won't do anything. We won't do anything at all. We might get angry. We might try to make an improvement, but whatever we do will not amount to a thing. And that's why we have to follow that up with, Lord, you not only tell me what's wrong, but you cause me to go in the right way. Again, it's in Psalm 119 where David says, make me to go. We need to ask God to do that from time to time. Lord, you know my nature. And Lord, I know what I'm supposed to do. And Lord, you know that I'm not going to do it. Lord, you know that. And if I'm honest, I know I'm not going to do it. So Lord, make me do it. So I would never, that would scare me to death. Realize that you have a loving God. You see, if that scares you to say, Lord, make me to do such and such, you have a wrong perspective of who your God is. Again, read those verses, how we're made in the womb and all of those things. So, in closing, what we see here in verse 23 and 24, here is a man who has emphatically made statements about God, realized some great truths about God, and when we get to verse 23 and 24, what he's saying is, I just want to be right with him. And that's where we all ought to be. That ought to be the desire of every heart of a saved individual. I just want to be right with God. Lord, whatever it takes, it'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. Just cause me to be right. And you see, the more we think upon God, the more we meditate upon these great truths of God, the more we come to this conclusion, I just want to be right with him. I just want to be right with him. And that's what you have here in verse 23 and 24. You have the desire of a man who wants to be right with God. And I pray that that is a desire of every one of us. We're going to fail. We're going to fail every day. We're going to fall every day. We're going to come short every day. But at the end of the day, it ought to be our desire. I just want to be right with God. I just want to be right with Him. What a life to be right with God. And that's a possibility. We can't be perfectly right in ourselves, but in Jesus Christ. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us verse of song.